Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. We start this edition of Prison Pipeline with a quick lesson in Latin. The phrase de facto, according to Britannica.com, quote, de facto, Latin, from the fact. A legal concept used to refer to what happens in reality or in practice, as opposed to de jure, from the law, which refers to what is actually notated in legal code, end quote. On February 12th, the NYU Center for Opioid Epidemiology and Policy hosted a seminar presented by Dr. Saba Rouhani, an assistant professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the NYU School of Global Public Health, entitled, You Don't Get Well in a Cell, examining the design, implementation, and impacts of de facto drug decriminalization policies in the United States. Here's Dr. Rouhani.
To talk about some early evaluation work that we did in Baltimore City, where I was based for a long time. And this was a site, Baltimore City actually was a site that enacted probably the most sweeping, comprehensive, unconditional model of de facto decriminalization of all of the 14 jurisdictions that we looked at. And just a little bit of context, Baltimore is really at the nexus of the kind of crises of overdose, incarceration, and racialized policing. These are slightly older data, but just showing that in Maryland, while overdoses in the among white residents have started to go down, they are actually increasing in the Black community. And there's a gross overrepresentation of Black residents in the prison and jail population. So they comprise about 29% of the statewide population and 68% of the prison and jail population. And although these overdose and incarceration numbers are statewide, there's data showing that this is driven almost exclusively by Baltimore residents. And actually within Baltimore, it's driven by data that's coming out of basically to a couple of neighborhoods within Baltimore. And then lastly, in 2015, a young man named Freddie Gray was killed by the police. And in Baltimore, this led to a huge uprising. The National Guard was brought in. There were curfews in place. There were, you know, tanks rolling through the street. The Department of Justice got involved and found systematic racially targeted unconstitutional police practices, and this led to a consent decree. And in this case, the state's attorney at the time, so the head prosecutor, actually charged all six police officers with the death of Freddie Gray. And the case ended up being very messy. All officers were acquitted, and I believe they all got back pay. But nonetheless, this led to huge tensions between the police and the prosecutor's office, right? So very well-documented hatred of the prosecutor by police in this context. And so given that background, this is the prosecutor in question, state's attorney Marilyn Mosby. She, at the beginning of COVID, implemented an unconditional and fully publicized de facto decriminalization model. She actually made a speech saying this is going to be the end of the war on drugs. So it was very widely disseminated. And the policy applied to all substances. There were no possession threshold limits placed. So the administration said they would still be charging drug selling, but the amount that somebody possessed would not be evidence of selling. So there were no threshold limits. They did retroactively apply the policy at the start of the pandemic. And the policy had the endorsement of the mayor's office and police leadership at the time. And I should also note that the policy applied to other like adjacent crimes as well. So sex work, loitering, things like that, that might also be used to criminalize people who use drugs. So the first thing we wanted to do was just look at whether arrests went down after this policy change. Given again the context that I shared about police having a contentious relationship with the prosecutor, but also, again, with a de facto policy, because the law doesn't change, police are not legally obliged to stop arresting at all. They would be completely within their rights to continue arresting, and then people would just not be charged at central booking, right? So we wanted to first measure, did the police even stop arresting? And if so, kind of examine those trends a little more closely. And then we also spoke with people who use drugs, and just to understand their experiences of like the nature of police interactions under policy exposure. So to look at arrest trends, we used interrupted time series models. And we compared, drug possession arrests before and after the policy. Now, obviously, there's a huge issue here, which is that the policy interruption period is exactly the start of the pandemic. And we know that following the pandemic, especially in those early months, there were huge implications for basically reduced street policing. And that's an issue that we continue to contend with. So this isn't, we're not making any causal inferences here, based on the analyses I'm going to share. I will say that we looked at other crime categories to see whether we could, start to try to account for how much of of our findings were accounted for by overall reductions to street policing versus specifically drug enforcement. But it's an issue that goes on. So what we found was that before the policy change occurred, there was actually already a really negative slope in drug possession. This is drug and paraphernalia possession arrests in Baltimore City. We were already seeing a decreasing trend by about 8 per month. And there were, after the policy change, nonetheless, we did see a pretty immediate decline. And then the number of arrests occurring, drug arrests per month, were decreasing, right? The slope remained negative. They were still decreasing by about one arrest per month. And this was through the end of 2021. And when we looked at some of those other crimes, robbery, assault, a variety, gun charges, violent crimes, a variety of other crimes, we did see some reduction in arrests after COVID, but it wasn't of the same magnitude, and also it wasn't as durable, right? So the effects started to wane much sooner, and many of them had already started to recover. So that's just to note. We also looked at these arrests stratified by race, and we found incredible disparities in arrests before the policy change occurred, declining trends in drug arrests in the Black community and in all other races, but a ratio of arrests occurring in the Black versus other races populations of about 5 to 1. And then after the policy change, we saw the greatest reduction of arrests in the Black community. But what we basically saw was like a floor effect in drug arrests among other races, right? So essentially, nobody was being arrested anymore after the policy change if they were not Black for drug possession in Baltimore. And the few people who were, again, despite substantial declines, the people who were continuing to be arrested were nearly exclusively in the Black community. And so we saw that disparity persisted at a ratio of 12 to 1. And lastly, you can read more about this, and we've published on these findings, but we did look at a couple of other things. Primarily in order to address this public concern of whether non-prosecution of low-level drug crimes might lead to more violence, we actually looked at those individuals who, at the start of COVID, had their warrants quashed and their charges dropped, et cetera. And we followed them through a data use agreement with the Maryland court system. We actually followed to see whether those individuals reappeared in the system for any crimes related to public safety, any violent crimes. And we found an extremely low level of recidivism in that regard. And then we also just looked at whether there was a commensurate increase in things like possession with intent to distribute, so drug selling charges, or driving while under the influence. So some of these crimes that people get, that there might be a replacement effect for. So sorry, my words. But basically what we were looking at was whether there was like an equal amount of increase in these other crimes that would suggest that that same amount of people who use drugs were being criminalized using other charges. And we didn't find that in this setting. I know it has been noted elsewhere, but I also will remind everyone that in this particular setting, in this unique time, there was a non-prosecution policy for a lot of low-level misdemeanor crimes. So I think it was a little harder for people to continue to be criminalized in that way. And lastly, we conducted some in-depth interviews with people who use drugs. This is kind of the least complete piece of the research so far that I'm going to share. So analyses are ongoing, but we did get some really interesting insights, as ever with qualitative research. So we found that people did corroborate the reductions in arrests. People were generally not very concerned about being arrested specifically. There was variable awareness of the exact policy provisions, but people knew that like they were not experiencing arrests very much. This wasn't perceived to be a huge threat. They did not so much anchor the reduction in arrests to the Mosby policy or even to COVID specifically. Most people actually talked about the Freddie Gray episode and the kind of changes to the city thereafter as the key initial driver that started changing their fear of arrest and their risk of arrest. However, they universally distrusted the police and had terrible experiences with them still. And they described a lot of ongoing stigma and harassment, especially during calls for assistance. And again, people described that there were basically specialized units, you know, wearing different, or coming in unmarked cars, or, you know, not regular street officers, but like specialized units that were coming in doing targeted drug enforcement, specifically targeting young Black men in the community for suspected drug distribution. And a lot of participants described to us how disruptive this was for their kind of their own overdose risk environment. So the way that this drug market enforcement created a volatile situation for them to have to continually find new suppliers was expressed as a concern and a challenge for people. So I think just kind of zooming out and looking at the early Baltimore attempts at evaluation here, you know, what's notable to me is that we did find substantial declines in arrests. Some of that may well have been accounted for by COVID. I don't think all of it was, but certainly that's a caveat. But we found that in a setting with such contentious relationships with police, and this was actually corroborated by some of the other prosecutors we spoke to, most of them said police will stop arresting eventually if they keep bringing people into central booking and see them immediately released. They may try to oppose or sabotage policy in other ways, but we did actually see and hear that arrest levels can go down after this kind of policy. But, you know, if we think about the causal pathway through which we would hope that decriminalization might have some positive impacts, the qualitative data is pretty sobering, because essentially what it tells us is that the nature of police encounters, even in the absence of arrest, and the paradigm of policing the drug market really continues to create challenges for people in terms of, you know, risk reduction and overdose prevention. And the very last thing I will say before we take questions is that since we conducted this work, State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby was in fact one of the prosecutors that was challenged and successfully defeated in the last election. And her successor, Ivan Bates, ran very much on a platform of restoring law and order to the city. There were other factors at play. It wasn't only this policy, but there certainly was this narrative of like the pendulum swinging back and restoring law and order. And State's Attorney Bates has since recriminalized simple drug possession. And So some of the ongoing work that we are doing in this area is we're essentially trying to add a third policy period to those models so that we can examine trends in arrest and eventually in health outcomes as well, criminalization, during decriminalization and during recriminalization, with, again, the ever-present challenge of the fact that the period of time under decriminalization overlaps perfectly with like acute pandemic years. So we are trying to kind of implement some more advanced causal inference methods and look at the use of synthetic controls or other ways to try to account, even regional controls, but to try to account for the COVID effect and understand, tease that apart from policy impacts. And then we this week launched a new study where we will be conducting in-depth interviews with police officers in Baltimore. We spoke to prosecutors there. We spoke with people who use drugs there. We'd like to also speak with officers, given how much of the implementation of these policies really like rests on their discretion and their behavior. And so we will be conducting 25 to 35 interviews with them over the next couple of months. And stay tuned for those findings.
We just heard Professor Saba Rouhani, PhD, presenting a seminar entitled You Don't Get Well in a Cell, Examining the Design, Implementation, and Impacts of De Facto Drug Decriminalization Policies in the United States, which was hosted February 12th by the NYU Center for Opioid Epidemiology and Policy. We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On February 8th, the Sentencing Project, Berkeley School of Theology, and the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation co-hosted a webinar examining the progress made in the 21st century in reducing the U.S. prison population and its racial and ethnic disparities, as well as the ongoing work to achieve justice. The Sentencing Project's 1 in 5 series notes that 1 in 5 black men born in 2001 is expected to be imprisoned within their lifetime. This actually represents progress. 20 years ago, 1 in 3 young black men were expected to be imprisoned. But we have a very long way to go in order to achieve equity. And rather than accelerate the pace of reforms, some policymakers are backtracking. This webinar, entitled 1 in 5, Ending Mass Incarceration and Its Racial Disparities, highlighted the Congressional Black Caucus's Criminal Justice Reform Task Force, focused on the systemic reasons behind mass incarceration, the work of the Center for Truth, Racial Healing, and Restorative Justice at Berkeley School of Theology, and how lived experience with incarceration can provide a deeper understanding of research and inform advocacy. Let's hear from one of the speakers. The Reverend Dr. Joseph Evans is director of the Center for Truth, Racial Healing, and Restorative Justice at the Berkeley School of Theology.
Thank you, Nazgul. And let me congratulate you on a comprehensive report that I believe everyone should read. In fact, I've read many of the different aspects of the report over and over again. I am the chair, as someone said, J. Alfred Smith, a senior professor of theology in the public square, and the director for the Center for Truth, Racial Healing, and Restorative Justice. Now, those words, truth, racial healing, and restorative justice, intersect, and that is one of the reasons why we are here today. The report that Nazgul and perhaps others on her staff and around her compiled and crafted and authored, that report is truth. And I urge you all to, again, to take a look at that report. And of course, the racial healing part, I think, is stands out. We're talking about, as you will find out from reading her report, and I would start with the executive summary. The racial healing part will focus on extreme sentencing. And then secondly, communities of color are over-policed. And then I think thirdly, and important is that we just heard, cash bail reform is an obstacle, frankly, in my view, to justice, and it's an undemocratic act. And so that helps us frame, at least from the Berkeley School of Theology's perspective, on how we would get involved. Let me give a couple of illustrations to bring you to date on how I personally got here on my journey. Prior to becoming an academic, I served two congregations as senior pastor, one in Huntington, West Virginia, which was in my home state, and secondly in the nation's capital. The first congregation in the town of Huntington, West Virginia, a college town, maybe about 70,000 people live there. So it was small enough for me to know a lot of different people, and particularly the magistrates who I had to visit over and over again to negotiate with them about predominantly African American men being caught into the system for doing similar things that students at the university literally sat outside in front of their dormitory smoking marijuana. Most of the people that I went to negotiate and advocate for were not down on the college campus smoking marijuana in front of the dorms. If anything, they were smoking it nearly somewhere near their house or on their porch or in their backyard. And there were jump out squads to come and arrest these young males. And that wasn't something that was really new to me. I'd been conditioned as a little boy to be aware that I could do anything wrong and literally be caught in the system for the rest of my life. If we fast forward and go to the nation's capital, where obviously is a much larger city, it was much more difficult to develop relationships with magistrates and others who had the gatekeeper on how young people would be treated. It was a city, and I love the city very much, but the jump out squads were just every day. And again, if we went to any major university in the nation's capital, you would see the same behavior that many of these young people were being caught into the system. So I have been looking at this for years now and becoming more impassioned about the undemocratic act that we're facing, again, with extreme sentencing, communities of color being over-policed, and then lastly, the cash bail reform. I can assure you that over years, I've had to raise money as a pastor just to try to get folks out of jail so that they could go home, not be in a dangerous environment for crimes that, frankly, oftentimes weren't proven they were even the persons that were involved in the crimes. But that takes a lot of money to be able to do that. Finally, I would just make the point in this opening segment that 20% of African American males will at some point in their lives be subjugated to the prison industrial complex. So if that's 2 in 5, that's 4 in 10. And if it's 4 in 20, you can do the math. 20% is a daunting number of young people who can literally be placed in a system, and frankly, it's really slavery by another name.
That was the Reverend Dr. Joseph Evans, director of the Center for Truth, Racial Healing, and Restorative Justice at the Berklee School of Theology. He spoke February 8th at a webinar entitled 1 in 5, Ending Mass Incarceration and Its Racial Disparities, which was co-hosted by the Sentencing Project, the Berklee School of Theology, and the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. Now let's hear William Underwood, senior fellow at the Sentencing Project.
My name is Bill Underwood. I work at the Sentencing Project on their campaign to end life imprisonment. I'm a senior fellow at the Sentencing Project. I know firsthand what Dr. Evans speaks of. Until 2021, I spent half of my life in federal prison. I was incarcerated in 1988. I got the opportunity to come home in 2021. And right now, there are nearly 160,000 people in federal prisons, and 3/4 of them are people of color. In 2018, Congress passed, and then President Donald Trump signed into law the bipartisan First Step Act. It was a sweeping criminal justice reform bill designed to promote rehabilitation, lower recidivism, and reduce excessive sentences in the federal prison system. Lawmakers and advocates across both political parties supported the bill as a necessary step to address some of the harsh and biased laws of the 1980s and 1990s. I'm a direct recipient of the First Step Act, so I work to encourage Congress to fully implement and build on the First Step Act in three key ways. First, Congress should correct a drafting error in the First Step Act that excluded the oldest and sickest people in federal prisons from compassionate release by passing the Safer Detention Act. This would give some of the most vulnerable people in federal prisons who have aged out of crime a chance to go home, at least to petition the court for a chance to go home. Second, Congress should make key provisions of the First Step Act retroactive with the First Step Implementation Act. And finally, Congress should build on the First Step Act's movement toward ending the racist disparity between crack and powder cocaine sentencing by passing the Equal Act. Crimes involving crack cocaine should not be punished more harshly than those with powder, and people serving unfair sentences deserve a second chance.
That was William Underwood, Senior Fellow at the Sentencing Project, speaking February 8th on a webinar entitled One in Five, Ending Mass Incarceration and Its Racial Disparities, which was co-hosted by the Sentencing Project, Berklee School of Theology, and the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. And finally, 1909 Shanghai Opium Commission, 1914 Harrison Narcotics Act, 1937 Marijuana Tax Act, 1961 United Nations Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs, 1971 Convention on Psychotropic Substances, 1971 President Richard Nixon declares drugs public enemy number one and vows to wage a new all-out offensive, 1982 President Ronald Reagan announces a new federal initiatives against drugs and organized crime, 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, 1988 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, 1990 Crime Control Act, 1994 Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act, and on and on and on, more than 100 years of arrests and incarceration and ever-increasing rates of substance use and addiction. And now in the present day of 2024, the Oregon legislature has approved House Bill 4002, which undoes the progress, undoes the reforms of voter-approved Measure 110, recriminalizing small-scale, simple possession of some drugs. Our police are bad at their jobs, their clearance rates are abysmal, but at least now they can generate a body count. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!